This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process. This is Lecture 4, entitled Anthroposophical Spiritual Science and Medical Knowledge, given in Vienna on October 2, 1923. Because the field I am going to speak about this evening is so broad and requires such detailed background information, it is very difficult to choose where to begin. Please allow me to say at least a few introductory words about anthroposophy's position on epistemological problems and on the overall soul constitution of the modern human being. As you know, the 19th century saw the full development of precise observation and experimentation on the one hand, and of the intellect and inferential reasoning on the other. These phenomena had been developing slowly since the 15th or 16th century, but in the 19th century they became definitive with regard to the problems and practical ramifications of epistemology. Anyone who has received a scientific education in any field does not question the need for experimentation and thinking in order to arrive at scientific results. The possibility of any other method will not even enter your mind, especially if you work in a specialized field. Under these circumstances, it is natural to shy away from speaking to specialists about the consequences of anthroposophical research for their own fields. It must be said, on the one hand, that only those well versed in scientific methodology should embark on anthroposophical research of the sort I will speak about. But, on the other hand, some of the results that have an impact on specialized fields are so paradoxical that it is much more tempting today to keep one's mouth shut than to talk about them. If I speak about them, nonetheless, I do so in the conviction that you have all come here, if not to be persuaded, then at least to hear something that can be taken seriously on a scientific level. Anthroposophy aims to be a field of scientific research, but it does not intend to stop short at the frame of mind that is nourished by the intellect and by physical experimentation. It attempts to acquire its insights by cultivating the forces of the human soul, trusting that just as small children possess undeveloped forces that unfold in adults, it is also possible for adults to augment their scientific education by developing their soul forces through a specific method. The most important of these soul forces is the power of memory or recollection. A few unbiased modern philosophers already say that the power of memory is indicative of the spiritual aspect of the human being. Developing this faculty depends on our ability to recall an event that is no longer immediately present. That is, we summon up from the soul's depths an event that no longer relates to any events in the immediate present, but whose inner makeup has a very specific rather than unspecific relationship to a particular reality. Now the question arises, can the activity of memory continue to develop just as the structure of the human brain continues to develop during the first years of life? Can memory create structures in the soul that reflect not only our own experience and our personal past, but also an earthly past that transcends human individuals? Is it possible to inwardly strengthen and transform our powers of cognition so that the resulting images, which require more intense exertion than memory, point to something that is otherwise outside the scope of human consciousness? If trust in the human soul's continuing ability to evolve serves as our starting point or postulate, and if we deliberately and precisely implement inner exercises that do not violate the soul's integrity in any way, tracing each step as if we were solving a mathematical problem, we will begin to have new experiences. These exercises, however, do not involve mathematics or the like. The reason for doing them is to take steps that result in personal development. For this purpose, we must call to mind mental images that are easily surveyed, so that no reminiscences can mingle with them. This activity is easiest for mathematicians, because they are already accustomed to focusing their mental activity on distinct contents. If we succeed in carrying out these exercises without tiring, and use them to enhance and strengthen the rather passive behavior we call memory, we become aware of an enhanced power of memory that safeguards the forces of earthly life that work on the organic level. We learn to extract this enhanced memory from the depths of our soul life. As a result, we survey a tableau, complete with temporal perspectives, inner laws, and inner structure, of all the events that have affected us since our entry into earthly life. The initial result is a view of the individual self. We become aware of the etheric body, a body within the physical body, whose intrinsic laws are temporal rather than physical. This body can appear in image form, and such cognition can be called imagination. In ordinary life, we live exclusively in the present, but imagination allows us to go back to any moment in time and experience it as if it were the immediate present. In the same way that we can move from one place to another in physical existence, we now learn to move on an inner level to any point in our past experience. We learn to speak of temporal perspectives, the existence of this finer second body, unrolling continuously in time, is perceptible to the first level of supra-sensible cognition. I must briefly point to a further level of soul development that is achieved when auto-suggestion eliminates the tableau of your own inner forces and their activity. This must be done in such a way that the result, rather than being simply an empty consciousness equal to zero, corresponds to the inverse of your current level of consciousness. This alternate consciousness results in complete inner stillness and peace. You may well imagine that when all outer impressions cease, the stillness that ensues is equal to zero, but in fact it is like the negative of your earlier consciousness. We arrive at inspiration rather than imagination, and learn to see human pre-earthly existence. This is no mere speculative insight, but a true view of the eternal aspect of the human being. We learn to investigate soul spiritual reality in the same way that we ordinarily investigate sense perceptible reality. And we learn to see these multiple aspects of the human being as a unity. There is no need to become involved in the ridiculous sparring between monistic and dualistic viewpoints, which is just as foolish as stating that chemists must be dualists because they say that water consists of hydrogen in combination with oxygen. We realize that each human being is part physical and part soul spiritual. We acknowledge the plastic, sculptural aspect of the brain, which is a reality as early as the embryonic stage of development. Let me use a comparison. A being that had never been on Earth might explain footprints on soft ground as the result of disembodied forces. But as truly as these traces were imprinted by a human being walking over the ground, the human brain shows the imprint of a soul spiritual factor. Thus we can understand the makeup of the human being as including both a physical body and a body of formative forces that we recognize through imaginative cognition. This more subtle entity within the human being remains the same over time, in spite of any change in physical substances. It is a self-contained reality that remains the same from one point in time to another. The issue becomes serious if we move on into specialized areas. The body of formative forces does not exist on the soul level. It leads at most to growth, but not to emotion. Next, we come to the astral body, the actual soul, and to the I organization. In the last 300 to 400 years, our developing knowledge has increasingly disregarded the spiritual, higher aspects of our human makeup. As a result, we have had to restrict ourselves more and more to what we can conclude from the physical structure of the human body. I always hesitate to explain these matters, because as a scientist I am quite capable of understanding that they infuriate scientifically educated people. Let's take a look inside the human body and trace the centripetal and centrifugal nerves, the so-called sensory and motor nerves. That is what we think we see, and I can fully appreciate the rationale behind this view. I can also fully appreciate how this supposed duality in the nervous system is supported by the phenomenon of tabes dorsalis, and so on. And there's that footnote, see page 19. When we are familiar with the higher members of the human constitution, however, the unity of the nervous system becomes apparent. Sensory nerves are adapted to transmitting sense impressions, but motor nerves have nothing to do with willed actions. Their task is to transmit peripheral sensations, such as the chemical and physiological processes that take place in the legs. Motor nerves are sensory nerves for perceiving the body's internal processes. As paradoxical as it may sound to modern science, we come to see human will as an inherent function of the soul itself, and to accept that movement and other consequences of our will are caused by the direct influence of the soul and spirit on the physical body. I would now like to point out the path that can lead to discovering this view of the human being. The human soul and spirit are the subject of all kinds of hypotheses on the part of modern anatomists, who generally have very abstract ideas about the contents of soul and spirit. Tsihin speaks only of the, in quotes, emotional emphasis of mental images. Footnote, Theodor Tsihin, 1863-1950, German philosopher, psychologist, and psychiatrist. Tsihin taught psychiatry from 1887 to 1912 and devoted the remainder of his life to philosophy. See his title, Introduction to Physiological Psychology. End of footnote. The soul, as we imagine it, has become so abstract and thin that we can no longer understand how it could possibly intervene in the physical body. As soon as we realize that the physical body extends from the solid element through fluids and gases all the way to warmth, we draw closer to the spiritual aspect of the human being. Of course, it is impossible to visualize the spirit intervening in the human body as modern science imagines the body to be. As soon as we assume the existence of a warmth organism, however, it is not so difficult to imagine the intrinsic forces of the etheric body working into differentiations in warmth within the human body. We have a great deal to learn, however, before we will be able to enliven our knowledge, which has become so fixed and rigid. We will eventually discover the bridge between the soul, which is more forceful than we now imagine it to be, and the physical body's more subtle manifestations. We will realize that our will nature intercedes directly in warmth processes and then moves on into the air organism and the fluid organism. We will also realize that the actual situation with regard to motor nerves is completely different from the conceptions modern science holds to be true. In reality, an activity involving the spirit, the soul, and the body takes place, and motor nerves allow us to become conscious of this activity, And that is the end of Lecture 4.